Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Proof. Everyone's hair is unique. Find your best hair at livingproof.com by taking a quiz to get your perfect mix of product. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Squarespace. Love can present challenges, but being modern with a website of your own can be easy with Squarespace. Start a free trial today and use their templates to express yourself. Go to squarespace.com and enter offer code MODERNLOVE to get 10% off your first purchase.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Gary Presley had all but given up on the idea of finding love. But as the romantics out there know, love can find you when you least expect it. And sometimes even when you're resisting it. Here's Colin Farrell, known for his work on the film In Bruges and HBO's True Detective, reading Gary's essay, Would My Heart Outrun Its Pursuer?
I am near quadriplegic, a result of polio, and I cannot stand. I have limited strength in my arms, enough to function once I'm in my chair, but not enough to get into or out of the chair. To be able to live in my own apartment as I desired, rather than in the custodial care of a nursing home, required the assistance of a rotating crew of attendants to transfer me from wheelchair to bed, bed to wheelchair, wheelchair to shower chair. You get the idea. 10 to 20 minutes in the mornings and in the evenings usually did the trick. The female attendants preferred to come in pairs, all the better to help a man into his bed and there undress him. I am somewhat deferential in the company of women, and I had made a conscientious effort to avoid any touch, any word that might be construed as improper. With that, the arrangement sailed along with no problems, soon settling into a job done and forgotten. At least until Belinda. A young mother of two boys showed up as half my attendant team. She was working evenings to pay for her college education. Earlier that day, I had noticed that part of the assembly of my shower chair was loose. "Do you know how to use a socket wrench?" I asked Belinda. "Sure," she replied. "I was a tomboy. I helped my father all the time when I was a girl." She had a silky sheet of straight brunette hair pulled together at the nape of her delicate neck, exotic dark hazel eyes and a dancer's lithe body. She may have grown up a tomboy, but what I saw was a beautiful woman. "There's a wrench set in the lower left drawer of my desk," I said. "Get it and I'll show you how this thing goes back together." As the days went by, Belinda sometimes began taking her turn on my transfer schedule without a co-lifter. "Doesn't it bother you to come alone?" I asked. "Why? I can outrun you." And with that, the necessity of my transfer faded into the background, and we began to talk about other things. Books and films, my work and hers. It seemed a natural evolution that after a few weeks, Belinda's routine occasionally included a friendly visit before she started her 3 to 11pm shift. One day, she dropped by with her sons. "This is Matthew and Christopher," she said. The boys spoke up, even though Matthew, the younger, held tight to his mother's skirt. It was evident she had told them about my wheelchair. Matt was all red hair and freckles, while Chris carried his mother's brunette colouring. And so it was that the man in a wheelchair, sardonic and standoffish, and the vibrant young woman who loved science and worried over how she would support her sons, developed an odd connection. A link to a place where hands might touch, but thoughts and feelings and emotions began to flicker like lightning beyond the horizon. I was past 40, My anger and frustration over being paralyzed mostly burned away. But it never occurred to me that the friendship, the connection between Belinda and me, might also be the bridge between caution and passion, between isolation and connection. "I really don't see the chair," Belinda said a few months after we met. "I see you." But I didn't believe her then. I had been paralyzed too young, when I was too callow and in a time and place where most people with disabilities were seen as invalids and shut-ins, passively accepting limitations and retreating behind an accepting smile to avoid injury, neglect, abuse or rejection. Belinda was 26, beginning study for a master's degree in microbiology, but she was also a single mother with minimal income. Nearly a decade had passed as she worked as a nurse's aide to pay for her classes and for daycare for her sons, and her life was becoming more hectic as she undertook graduate studies. I did not know how to love, not then, but I knew how to be a friend. I tried to help her with her boys, getting them ready for the bus when she had an early appointment, watching them after school and seeing that homework was done and bellies filled. One late summer day, Belinda asked me to accompany her to the nearby university city. "I need a man's opinion on what a professional woman should wear," she said. The master's program allowed her to supplement her income by working as a graduate teaching assistant. She was apprehensive about looking the part, and so we set out in my van. On the way, as we passed a restored Volkswagen Beetle in the adjacent lane, she pointed to it and said, "One of these days, I'm going to find one of those and rebuild it." Only half listening, I murmured, "If wishes were horses, beggars would ride." "What a mean thing to say," she snapped, turning away. She was driving my van. I sat behind her with my wheelchair secured by tie-downs. "I'm sorry," I said automatically, but I didn't understand what caused her reaction. The sardonic aphorism made perfect sense to me. I was an expert on wishes. "People have a right to dream," she said. We were quiet as Belinda bought dresses. She liked floral prints. I liked a navy blue with tiny white polka dots. I bought lunch and we drove to my apartment. As we waited for her boys' school bus to arrive, she sat on my couch, still subdued, her legs tucked under her, dark hair cascading down the side of her face. She gazed out the front window at the row of cedar trees along the driveway. "I really didn't mean to hurt your feelings," I said. "It's all right. I shouldn't be so sensitive." I could see her despair reflected in the slump of her shoulders. I knew about despair. I wore it like a familiar coat, incapable of accepting what must be tolerated and petulantly ignoring what must be acknowledged. But at that moment, at the sight of such sadness in one usually so open and upbeat, sadness in the spirit of a woman who needed something from me, I wanted to offer more than mumbled words of apology. But I also knew that to push myself deeper into her world might carry us to a place where I might lose what I had made of myself. A place where I knew I could no longer hold tight to the hard reality that kept me sane. I believed I did not deserve to love Belinda. I believed I should not allow her to love me. I held hard to the idea I should be content to ride out the remainder of my life without complaint. A burned-out case, an absurd hodgepodge of broken parts, a beggar who no longer wished for a horse. But she was also a woman. Beautiful and vibrant, and I was a man, in a wheelchair, true, but a man full of heat and desire that sometimes rendered the chair irrelevant. And I was the keeper of an obscene little secret I had known perhaps since I had been stuck in the iron lung, and surely from some vague moment later, the point where I realized I would never walk again. It is a thing that will sit rancid in my gut until the day I die, a thing that until then had eaten away at any illusion that love and marriage for me would be like it was in books or movies. And it was this. I would be physically dependent upon those who might love me. I am a chore, an obligation, and I will ever be so. I could not rationalize how a woman might love me and not soon come to hate the millstone I believed myself to be. All this ricocheted through my mind, not in words but in a fog of melancholic unease as I stared at Belinda. Suddenly she moved from the couch and across the few steps between us. I opened my arms, and she dropped into my lap and put her head on my shoulder. There was no sound, no words between us, only her tears and my silent wonder. Friends, lovers, perhaps that day was a hint that there might be a path through the thicket of my insecurities. I only remember the gift, the magic, the seamless transition from what I could never imagine into that which I will treasure until my last breath, a kiss, a touch, the sweet scent in the shadow of her neck. We should stop this, you know, I said, my mouth against her hair. You need to find someone else. Where can I find a man silly enough to stay home with my boys when they have chicken pox? She replied, smiling and lifting up to kiss the top of my head. I like it that you put me first. Months later, Belinda stopped by my apartment and held out a small box. Inside was a man's wedding ring, a wide band with oak leaves inlaid into its surface. See if it fits, she said. We now approach 2 decades married, and I sometimes still wonder what love has wrought. I sometimes think Belinda might see in me a thing to nurture, a place to sacrifice, an altar on which to offer love. But I also feel something else. That glow from 2 decades ago. That heat between a woman and her mate. Cynics say romantic love is a fiction. I have been thoroughly in love only once, and I think it a mystery, an enigma, a Gordian knot entwining 2 spirits. But even now, I cannot fully resolve myself to the reality of Belinda's love. I choose to love Belinda, choose against my head logic and with my heart dreams. And even now, I confront the tasks with which she helps me each day with a mixture of the guilt and gratitude, resentment and appreciation, anger and bemusement. And somewhere deep in my psyche, an old, ugly beggar sleeps, unaware that the man Belinda chose to love has gotten on his horse and ridden away.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing?
It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question,
you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building.
Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Colin Farrell, reading Gary Presley's essay, Would My Heart Outrun Its Pursuer? We'll hear from Gary himself after the break.
Support for Modern Love, the podcast, comes from Living Proof, the science behind healthy hair.
I'm Katie from Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, I started using your product several years ago. My friends and family started complimenting me on my hair and asking what I'd done. Six of them now use Living Proof products. Love, Tamara. Use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And now a postscript from Gary Presley, author of this week's essay on life with Belinda today.
We've been married 25 years next year. She has remained devoted to me in a way that I really don't understand. I don't know that I would have the same will, the same heart, the same ability to love beyond what love is to most people. The fact that people with severe and chronic disabilities have an interest in love, sex, and romance is foreign to some people, and that's what led to the Modern Love essay.
My name is Belinda, and I am Gary Presley's wife. I have a severe hearing impairment, so my disability is hidden. Most people don't see it, but his, you know, he rolls around in a wheelchair. And while in the beginning it was difficult trying to learn how to work together, that's a choice. When you choose to love somebody, you have to accept everything.
A big part of working together for Belinda and Gary has been cheering on each other's professional lives. In the time they've been married, Belinda has completed two master's degrees, and she received her doctorate earlier this year. Gary published a memoir in 2008 titled Seven Wheelchairs, A Life Beyond Polio. They've also teamed up on another effort, parenting. In addition to sons Matthew and Christopher, they adopted a daughter almost 7 years ago and their foster parents to two-year-old twins.
There's some advantage to being a parent with a disability in that it silently instructs by example that life isn't perfect, that kindness and accommodation are necessary. As for me, I'm much kinder, much slower to anger than I was 25 years ago. I've learned to use a sense of humor and a sense of being oblivious to other people's reactions. And Belinda's taught me that. Some of that you learn on your own, but some of that also comes from having total acceptance from another person.
As a child with a disability, there's a lot of stigmas placed on me, and what he has given me is the chance to grow into the person that I was wanting to be. With his support emotionally, I'm the same way with him. I don't judge him. I don't treat him like he's been treated in the past. And so I think that common bond and common need has allowed us both to grow together. He has been the best friend I have ever had. I could not imagine my life without him.
I've been paralyzed 56 or 7 years, and I never would have thought that love would have come to me in this form. We never can predict what life holds for us.
Gary Presley, author of this week's essay, Would My Heart Outrun Its Pursuer? We also heard from his wife, Dr. Belinda Presley. They live with their daughter and two foster children in a rural area of southern Missouri. Now, this idea of possibility that Gary talks about, that resonated with Colin Farrell himself. He told us it was part of why he chose Gary's essay.
One of the most horrendous things about a physical disability is that it cuts into the hope of the person who is experiencing the affliction. And so the ability to love or be loved is something that all of a sudden is birthed into this cloud of suspicion and this cloud of doubt. And from the outside looking in, that seems to me one of the most heartbreaking aspects of this story, but the story doesn't go there. There is no giving in to the doubt. There is only giving in to the potential of loving and being loved. And so I was incredibly moved by it.
And our special thanks to Colin Farrell for reading Gary's essay. The actor has another love story to share in the dystopian dark comedy The Lobster, which hits theaters this Friday. And now, Modern Love editor Daniel Jones.
What I love about Gary Presley's essay is his feeling of inadequacy and how this lifelong disability has turned him into someone who doesn't think that he deserves to be loved. And what a huge, like, added disability that is. There's that aphorism that says, you have to love yourself before someone else can love you. And I've seen essay after essay where the opposite is true. Someone else has to love you before you then recognize yourself as being worthy of love. And she sort of rescues him in that way, even as he's helping her and rescuing her too. I feel like in any long-term relationship that works, each person is equal parts burden and gift to the partner. Because if it gets out of balance and one person is all gift and the other person is all burden, it's not going to last. So we all bring these, both all this negative pessimism mixed with optimism and love mixed with bitterness. We all bring all of that to every relationship. I see in most people who submit to Modern Love and most people I meet in life a real combination of total romantic and total cynic. And I think that's true with Gary in his essay. Just on a level of writing and lyricism to his writing alone, he's a romantic, you know? He might deny it in person, but he is clearly someone who dreams and who sees their situation ultimately as this unlikely love story. He just feels lucky that he found someone who reciprocated that and saw that in him.
Modern Love editor Dan Jones. Special thanks to Colin Farrell for reading this week's essay. His new movie, The Lobster, hits theaters this Friday. Next week on Modern Love, Thaisa Farmiga reads a story about friends without benefits.
He was always looking for the next best thing. I apparently made too good of a friend for him to justify anything more significant. Who was I, anyway? A friend? A roommate? A drunken neighbor with nowhere to sleep? Did even I know who I was?
Well, we want to know what you think of this week's episode and every episode. Write us a review on iTunes and connect on Twitter with the hashtag ModernLovePodcast. Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It is produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM and the Go License Collection at ghostlysongs.com. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.